Hello, hello, and a happy Friday. Welcome back to Minority Report's podcast and digital series. I'm your host, Mona Sheikh. I'm so happy that it's Friday today. It has been a bit of a long week. I'm exhausted, and I'm very excited to wrap this up earlier than usual and to get on with it. However, I have a very special guest with us today. He is an author, he is a speaker, and he's a founder of Unmistakable Media. And recently, you can see him on the very latest and quite the popular show on Netflix, Indian Matchmaking. And he is one of the prospects on the show. His name is Srinivas Rao, and here he is. Hi, Srini. Welcome.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. This is awesome. How's your Friday been?
It's good. We're about at that time to start drinking. It's 5 o'clock here, so you got me, you know, much to my dismay at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday.
Oh, man, I'm so sorry. Thank you for being support and playing along. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, no worries.
I want you to guess, it's straight vodka or water?
You know what? I would go with straight vodka, but that looks more like water, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm not that cool, man. I'm not that cool. You know what? I was just watching your reel on LinkedIn, and I loved every second of it.
Thank you.
Because you talk about creativity in the business setting, and you know, and not just limited to being somebody like me who's a, you know, who's a stand-up comic or a producer and all that, but yeah. You talk more about it in the business setting. So can we just go, I mean, you founded Unmistakable Media about 10 years ago. So can we talk a little bit about that and how you got into it?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I am sort of the you know, sort of ultimate accidental, you know, entrepreneur. Like, none of this was part of any grand plan or anything like that. You know, like, yeah. I got out of business school. I couldn't find a job. It was 2009. So that was a horrible time to get out of school of any kind. Yeah. And as you probably know, depending on how old you are, like, the market was just garbage. And, you know, I found myself living at my parents' house. I needed something to do to pass the time. And so I enrolled in this online course on how to start a blog, and about, you know, one of the lessons in it was interview somebody as a way to get traffic. And so I basically spun it into a weekly interview series. And the 13th guy I interviewed said, "You're a much better interviewer than you are a writer," which to this day I still think is true. You know, he suggested spinning it out into a separate site. So we started out as this like podcast for bloggers called Blogcast FM. And then one of, you know, the people I interviewed ended up being my first mentor, and he kind of shifted our direction pretty drastically in 2014, where he said, "Let's just rebrand the whole thing as Unmistakable Creative," because we started to notice some interesting patterns in the content that I liked creating, as well as the ones that resonated with our listeners. And we didn't ask our listeners who were online entrepreneurs or anybody. We had other friends who would listen just for entertainment's sake. And so we went to them and we're like, "You guys are actually a more representative sample of what we want. What do you like? Like, what episodes do you like?" And like, "We don't care about any of the ones that have to do with like blog traffic or any of that stuff. They like the ones with interesting stories." And so this mentor basically said, he's like, "You can do this with anybody." He said, "It's just a, you know, kind of depends on the questions that you ask each person." And so as a result, we kind of shifted the focus of the show to being much more about interesting people than business per se. So as a result, you get this very, you know, bizarre lineup of guests that have ranged from bank robbers to billionaires and porn stars to presidential candidates. Yeah. And that was by design. Like, we thought about this from the start. We're like, we're designing for scale because we want to be able to reach the widest possible number of guests. Like, you know, I mean, widest possible number of listeners, like, that would be amazing. But at the same time, you also know you're going to appeal to certain people and you're not. And even with the interviews, right? Certain interviews, we know, you know, really strike a chord. Other ones don't. You know, like today I created something that I thought was like the best thing we've done 10 years, and two of my friends were like, "Yeah, like, we don't love it." I'm like, "Wow, okay." But I know certain people will, because it was really special to me. And so that's usually my sort of litmus test, is that if I don't feel it, nobody else will. Like, I think that's a really good test for emotional resonance and content. Mm-hmm. And so that's really kind of been the philosophy behind why I made many of the choices I do for guests, why we chose to create the content we do. And so, you know, as a byproduct of this sort of unexpected career, I've ended up getting to write books with publishers, you know, have a public speaking career. Like I said, it's one of the weirdest things because there's no way you could have planned any of this. Like I always jokingly tell people, I was like, the worst career advice I could ever give you was to reverse engineer what I did. It's like, go get fired from all your jobs, live at your parents' house until you're 38, and then you'll be a best-selling author. That's nonsense. That will never happen. That's terrible career advice. I don't think anybody should follow it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, you as a creative person, you can probably appreciate this, but I think it's also important to acknowledge the role that, you know, circumstance and luck played in all of this. You know, I was reading Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers again this morning because I hadn't, you know, I'd only listened to the audiobook years ago. And I actually, despite being a podcast host, despise audiobooks. Like, I can't stand them. I find them to be too long. I don't even listen to podcasts, to be honest. Like, I it's actually my least preferred form of media, despite...
Are you not even going to listen to this later, Srini? Is that...
I will. I'll go back and listen to this, because one thing I realized is when I go back and listen...
For sure. To, you're like, yeah.
The reason I do is because every time I go back and listen to an interview that I've done, it gives me ideas for things that I want to write about, and that's the main reason I do it, is to go back, you know? Not that I just want to hear the sound of my own voice. Don't get me wrong. I don't dislike the sound of my voice, but...
Listen, first of all, I want to know, what is it that you're drinking?
This is Bullet Rye Bourbon.
That's what you were drinking yesterday. One week.
That seems to be our go-to these days. You know, you're three guys living together in a pandemic. That's what happens.
Bullet Rye, the two go-to.
Yeah, I mean, we have wine some nights, but bourbon seems to be more and more prevalent lately.
You know, you were just talking about porn stars to presidents, and I was like, yeah, well, this administration has made that very accessible.
That's a good point. Yeah, I never thought about it that way.
Very, very accessible, because our president's like, even porn stars can be president of the United States now.
Well, you know, the thing that I really, you know, I think that people thought, like, you know, like, you might think, oh, is Srini just trying to, like, you know, be a pervert and, you know, get some, like, porn star guest? And it's like, no, truth be told, to me, what I was really interested in was understanding a subculture and approaching it like a cultural anthropologist and saying, okay, like, what is it about this sort of underground world that, like, none of us are part of? Like, we witness it and experience it through whatever media we consume, but we don't know anything about what these people are really like, what their lives are really like. So I was just genuinely curious. Like, I wanted to know those things. And so I thought, oh, this is one of those things that I can cross off my list. And, you know, at first I was like, wow, this is going to be potentially offensive to parents who listen to this, because we have a lot of parents who listen to our content and they use it to homeschool their children.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, I was joking with one of my teammates. I was like, wow, I've managed to make an interview with a porn star tasteful. Don't get me wrong. She dropped plenty of F-bombs and, like, talked very graphically about sex, but at the same time, she was super smart. She had a lot of really insightful things to say, and I felt that it was, like, basically sex education from a porn star, which was phenomenal.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, my approach to this is sort of a trifecta of, is it entertaining? Is it educational? And is it inspiring? Like, those three things are what I look for in every person. And so that's given me this really cool sort of, you know, checkered past and bizarre career that I kind of cobbled together through a series of creative projects and just impulses that I've acted on. And it's kind of paid off in a way that I didn't expect it to. It's just kind of turned into, you know, things I never expected. Like, I never in a million years imagined I would be on a Netflix dating show like that, you know. Really never was one of those things that I'd imagine was going to be part of my life.
I think your path kind of reminds me a little bit of mine, in the sense that, first of all, I never dreamt of ever becoming a stand-up comic. That was never, like, you know, that's not a thing. First of all, I grew up in Pakistan. So let's just get that out of the way. Pakistan, yeah. A girl growing up in Pakistan, that's not the first thing that goes through your mind. You're not like, I'm gonna tell jokes on stage, and your mom's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, that's not how this shit works. And I think for me, I just kind of fell into stand up. I think I was just, like, meant to do stand up, and I just kind of fell into the pathway. But I feel like our generation, and, you know, even, and now the younger generation, more even the ones after the generation after us, they just have, like, more of a freedom to be able to do the things that they love, right? We're not kind of, we were that generation that had the ability to get away from the traditional stuff, that we had the ability to, like, just kind of break away and say, I don't want to be a doctor, I don't want to be an engineer, you know, or I don't want to be a wife to someone and have five children. Like, that's not the fucking path I want. Okay, I want to be my own fucking person. And I think we've been able to do that, which is, thank God for that. But
yeah, can I comment on that really quick?
Yeah,
the thing about that is, I think we're still wrestling with that narrative, right? Because it's taken, you know, like I think that to me, the most valuable thing to come out of having been on the show, because like I was literally the token misfit, as I joke, like I was the one who literally didn't fit the mold of any of what anybody was looking for, which is why I say I'm like, I'm every Indian mom's worst nightmare come true, you know? Right. So it was like, I'm probably not the ideal future son-in-law for you. But at the same time, I think it also was a phenomenal opportunity to have a conversation about how we as a culture, South Asians, define what it means to be ambitious, what it means to be successful, and to look beyond sort of, you know, what is surface level. Because I think that that to me was the thing I took away from the whole experience, was to say, okay, like, fine, you know what? The making connections part is great. In fact, you know, I wrote a piece about this. You may have read it, about, you know, what I called the arms race for impressive biodata. But I made a point to also highlight the positives, because I didn't want it to come across as, oh, there's nothing good about this. There's plenty good about this, like the family values that come from it, the discipline that, you know, Indian parents instill. Because look, even as a creative, like that discipline to me, even though they put it into context that they wanted to see it put into, now as a writer, it's invaluable. Like I could not do what I do without the fact that my parents trained me that no matter what it is, you work. And you know, my friend Ryan Holiday was like far more well known than I am as an author. He has similar conversations with parents. He's like, you know, doesn't matter whether you're a writer, whether you're creative. He's like, whatever you do, it's a job. And, you know, fortunately, people like you and I get to do work that we love, even though it comes, you know, with an opportunity cost of potentially being judged, misunderstood, and also sometimes the cost of, you know, security and, you know, what and values that are often not aligned with the ones that we were raised with.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. We are still kind of wrestling with that narrative. I mean, in my case, I guess my life story is also very highly unusual for, I think, even from like any Indian, Pakistani, or just South Asian perspective, period. I have four older brothers. I'm the youngest and the only girl. I moved from Pakistan at 15. By the time I was 18, I packed up my bags and I left, and I've been on my own ever since. So in many ways, just like, it's funny that you said that you're every Indian parent's worst nightmare. I always say that I'm every Desi parent's worst nightmare. That is like literally my saying. I say it all the time. I'm like, you know, I'm single, I'm not married, I, you know, I've been on my own forever, I pursue stand-up comedy. I mean, I like just all the negatives, just across the board, you know. And I'm very proud of it, honestly. I wouldn't live my life any other way. I'm very happy for the life choices I've made. I have girlfriends who live in Pakistan, and they get in touch with me and they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm a stand-up comic. They're like, that makes sense. That makes total sense, because that's what you were when you were a kid. So that makes total sense. But they're like, we're married, we're freaking miserable, we have kids, we don't have any time for any creative stuff. And it's not to say that married people don't have happy lives. I'm sure they do. But the ones that I come across, or my former classmates, they're not very happy about it. I want to ask you about how, first of all, where in India is your family from?
We're from Andhra Pradesh, so we're Telugu. It's funny because somebody wrote an article. My cousin just sent me a note. He was like, dude, I didn't know we were Tamil. I was like, yeah, neither did I. But luckily, I contacted the journalist. I said, hey, thank you. That was a really sweet write-up. I really appreciate how kind you were. Do you mind just making that one correction? I was like, it doesn't matter to me, but I'm sure my parents would appreciate it. Even my sister was like, yeah, man. He was like, we're just trying to give Telugu people a good name. But yeah, no, I mean, yeah, I'm from South India. I think that, you know, like most Indians, I was raised with sort of the standard Indian culture values and sort of career advice of, you know, security, stability. And, you know, here's the thing, like when you think about the way that Indian immigrant parents raise their kids with this value of security, you have to take into account the context that they're giving you this advice from, because I'm sure just for like your parents, like their life outcomes were fairly binary. It was poverty or security. There's nothing in between in those situations. You know, this is not living in America. So for them, even starting here, it was kind of the same thing. You know, I mean, if you look at most immigrants, like I remember for the longest time, I used to think, oh, you know, like I don't want my parents' life. Now I don't want certain parts of it, but now I look at it and I was like, wow, you guys have built an incredible life for yourself. Like to have started with what you did and, you know, 25 years later to have, you know, be in a situation like I can't afford my parents' house. You know, it's, and there was a time when I thought, oh, you know, like I, you know, don't really, like to me, this isn't good enough. And now I'm like, wow, I'm like, who am I, how ungrateful was I to think that? So As I said, it's a double-edged sword. Now, you mentioned, you know, families and you know, people, friends of yours who are married. Everything has an opportunity cost. It's not like we get to do the kinds of things that you and I do without having an opportunity cost. Like, what do you give up? You give up security. And, you know, like, I would be lying to you if I said I didn't want to start a family and all that stuff. I mean, I went on a dating show for a reason. Right. Like, that was definitely part of the motivation. I was like, okay, cool. But yeah, no, I think it's important that we acknowledge the pros and cons and you know, both sides, like the good things. But I think that we, like I said, to me, what this gave me the opportunity to do was to amplify a you know, sort of cultural narrative, and I think a feeling that a lot of people in our generation have had for a very long time.
Yeah.
And I just happen to have a platform on which to do it in a much bigger way than I've ever had before. You know, I always have with the podcast for 10 years, but this was kind of like, okay, I get to take it to another level. Yeah. And so to me, that was what was worth talking about here, more than the show itself, more than the experience, which I know, you know, people have wanted to talk about. I've been really lucky because the press doesn't seem to give two shits about my relationship status, mm-hmm. only my work, which is great because, you know, nobody knew anything about me even after the whole show. It was like, who is this guy? Like, all they had to go on was, oh, I guess I'll have to go Google him, because, you know, my appearance was limited, my time on it was limited. Yeah. And, you know, it's been nothing but positive. Like, I've had no downsides to this.
Yeah. I mean, your family's from Andhra Pradesh. My family's from Uttar Pradesh. Yeah. Which is, they're like next door to each other, aren't they?
That I couldn't tell you. My geography of India is probably not on point right now. I'd have to Google it to see.
I think they're next. I don't know. I've never been to India. I'm born in Pakistan. I tried. Veer Das wanted me to come out and perform in Pune and Mumbai, and they wouldn't give me the visa because I'm born in Pakistan. So there's that. But we're still working on it. So the moment Shah Rukh Khan sends me that invite, I'll be there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other, like, you know, geopolitical conversation of utter bullshit and nonsense. I'm always kind of amazed by that. I remember I was at a surf camp in India. I was like, can you guys explain to me why there is this ongoing conflict? And I listened to them and I was like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. Ibuprofen and Advil having a fight is what's happening. It's stupid. I'm sure you're getting asked these questions. I honestly, you know, every time I bring on my guests who've been on different shows and, you know, like TV shows and things like that, I try not to ask like the same questions that everyone's asking. I actually, when I saw you, I think the first impression that you gave off to me was of a very grounded person who knew himself pretty well. I swear to God, that's how you came across. And I was like, Srini seems like a guy, he seems to know what the hell is going on. He seems pretty confident. Like when you were sitting down and when you go to meet the family. Okay, can we just talk a little bit about Aparna?
So here's the thing. I want to be very clear. I'm not going to say anything bad about anybody. No, like,
I'll do that job.
Look, at the end of the day, somebody asked me on Twitter, like, you know, what is your side of the story? And I was like, pretty much what her side of the story is. We're not on the same page, and we're definitely not. I didn't know that's how it was going to shake out. I wasn't there. I showed up to film. We had the date. We actually, I mean, you saw the date. It looked like a relatively, you know, pleasant time. But I was also clear. Like, I was like, I'm not moving to Houston. I'm a surfer and snowboarder. There's no fucking way I'm moving to Houston. It's just not in the cards. And I was actually really upfront. I said, you know, like, you're cool. Like, I actually, you know, so in all honesty, I didn't have a bad time. Like, it was perfectly fine. I didn't anticipate it coming out like that. But truth be told, that's turned out to be the best publicity we could have asked for. Because the thing is, I think if that hadn't happened, I would have just been sort of this afterthought. You know, it's like, oh, okay, that was interesting. Who is this guy? But I think that puts so much attention on that. And the truth is that, you know, anybody who's attempted to engage with me around that, I have actually deflected it and said, no, you know what, like, cool, whatever. I thank you for saying so many nice things about me. I hope you check out the podcast. Like, I'm far more interested in, you know, connecting with people about my work than I am about that. Now, as far as the whole, you know, grounded, you know, confident person, look, I'm as fucked up as everybody else. You know, like, I'm a normal human being. I say things on a daily basis to my roommates that would be a PR crisis in the making. But I am... I think the thing that, you know, and I've talked about this in a few other shows, is that what I had going into this, I think, was the fact that I understood what it meant to have a public presence, because I already had one. And I understood that in a public presence, particularly like mine, when you have investors, you have, you know, publishers, you have literary agents, that everything you do at that point is no longer a reflection on just you, but a reflection on every single person who has bet on you. Yeah. And that includes my listeners, you know, like the community that I've spent years building. So whether, you know, I have chemistry with somebody or not, like that doesn't matter. It doesn't, to me, justify, you know, being like, oh, this is a horrible person. So I understood that. I knew that. I was self-aware enough to know that. That doesn't mean I don't have, you know, serious issues like any normal human being. Like, I remember when I found out about the meeting with the parents, I was like, what the hell? They didn't tell me that on the night before. And I told my dad, I was like, holy shit. And I called my dad. He's like, oh, be polite. I was like, seriously, man, you're a college professor. Like, come on. That's lousy advice. But here's the thing that I realized was my ultimate edge is that I'm an interviewer. And if you notice that interaction with Seema, I didn't answer a single question. And that was by design because I had one goal in that car ride. I was like, you know what? If I'm going to be on Netflix, I want to showcase one thing, my skills as an interviewer, not anything else, particularly in the conversation with Seema. Like, I mean, look, I went there with every intention of being open to it. But the other thing is I also learned a long time ago that, you know, this is something that took me a long time to get my head around was that I spent years struggling with my dating life. Think about it. I'm 40 and single on a dating show. Like, that should tell you that something went wrong here. Like, what the hell?
What are you trying to say, Trini? What are you trying to say?
No, with me, not you. With me, not you. Just,
you know, I'm not the same age as you, single, stand-up comic. Come on, man.
So that's the thing. And it was one of those things where I realized all my self-worth was based on external validation, largely from women. And so that is a really unhealthy way to go into, like, not just an interaction and a date, but any interaction, period, where you basically give this person so much power in which you control nothing about that situation. And so, like, my attitude from that point forward was zero expectations. And, you know, needless to say, when I went to dates that way, they turned out well. And it was like, oh, okay. Like, why go in? Because the thing is, like, you go in with expectations as a setup for disappointment. Whereas how can you expect so much of somebody you've never met? That's such a tall order on that person. And it's so much pressure. Yeah. And so I just felt that there was no need for that. And that I was there to be who I was. Now, keep in mind, so one thing that, you know, people have gotten really, my brother-in-law and other people have gotten my case about was that I completely downplayed all of the things I've done career-wise. Like, if you notice that scene when she asked what I did for work, the only regret I had was that I didn't mention the name of the podcast, but I never mentioned book deals. I never mentioned any of this. Yeah. And part of that was strategic. Like I said, the only, you know, real goof was not mentioning the name, which still I'm like, fuck, you know, that would have helped the conversion rate. The thing is, people, you know, as a result are like, oh, I need to go Google this guy to find out about him. Yeah. But the thing is that was such an opportunity in my mind to look at how we go back to that conversation about how do we value ambition, but more importantly, how do you assess somebody's character? Like, I didn't want to be, you know, judged based on my accomplishments. Like, I've had that before. It's like, oh, you're impressive because you did this, this, and this. And I was like, no, I'm not. I got lucky in a lot of ways. Yeah, I worked hard, but you know, like, I don't want that to be the lens through which people see me. I mean, in fact, like, when I've matched on dating apps with people and dated them for a while, I've had to ask them, I was like, I would really prefer that you don't actually read my books, that you don't listen to our podcast or any of that until I've gotten to know you. Because I think that what you're going to do is you're going to see me through this filter, which is me as the, like, you know, sort of superhuman version of myself in, like, this moment, which is not me every day, you know, not even close. So, you know, it causes this sort of weird projection of who you are. You know, like, I think you saw the post I put up. Somebody had sent me a you know, when I said, hey, you know, a journalist that I was talking to on Twitter, like a super cool guy that, like, I now, like, oh, wow, I'm glad that I've met him. He's, like, just super nice. And we seem to be having some great conversations. So he said, hey, man, I'm a longtime journalist. Why don't I interview? Because she's like, I'm sure people want to hear you on your own show about this, and because there are a lot of new listeners. And so, you know, and I don't ever, very rarely, I think in 1,000 interviews, I've appeared as the guest maybe twice, two or three times. Yeah. And that was mainly for book launches. And so I was like, yeah, okay, fine, I'll do it. But one of the funniest questions I got is, would you consider being somebody's life coach for, or the contestant's life coach for season two? I was like, do you have any idea what I'm like? I'm like, I would be horrible. I'll make these people. Like, I don't have enough empathy to be a life coach. I'll be like, you're a fucking idiot. I'm like, and I have too many problems of my own. Like, I don't want to be your life coach. And so.
Everybody's got problems, man. But
yeah, it's amusing. The funny thing is, right, like that people have that perception based on 5 minutes. You know, this is another metaphor that came up for me is that you Seth Godin always talks about this book, Understanding Comics, by a guy named Scott McCloud, right? And Scott McCloud says that, like, if you read the book, one of the things he talks about in comic books is that it's not actually what happens in the panels, but what happens between the panels where the story takes place. And I think that's such a profound metaphor for the way we experience media. You know, it's like, who am I between Instagram uploads and, you know, like 10 minutes on a camera? I'm a guy who, you know, is drinking scotch at 2 o'clock in the afternoon playing video games with my roommate. Like, that's normal to me. Like, that's who I really am. And so I think that that's the one thing that is really interesting about being put in a position where you have, you know, a public presence. And you know, my public presence was sizable, not massive. Like, it wasn't massive, but it wasn't tiny. But what I did have, which became very clear to me from how the comments unfolded based on, you know, the journalist coverage, was a very, very loyal audience who apparently all watched this thing.
I think, you know, Srini, I'm not shocked to hear about the loyal audience. I feel like vulnerability and authenticity, I'm going to specifically talk about vulnerability. And I think for me personally, when I watched you, there was a vulnerability about you that I instantly felt connected to. And I was like, this guy, and I think the reason I use the word grounded is because I felt that you were someone that was really out of the ordinary in the sense that you don't kind of fit that. Like that Desi guy mold.
Not even close. I think that's largely why I was chosen because I was like the, you know, like I said, I jokingly refer to myself as Indian matchmaking's token misfit. Like, I was like, who the fuck are you guys going to match me with? I'm like, this should be interesting. I was like, I can only imagine, you know, the choices that you're going to make. But yeah, I mean, to me, even, you know, like I said, I mean, I have been like looking back and reflecting on it. It just made me want to tear apart the whole concept of biodata. I was like, we should get rid of this word from our language. It's the most like degrading thing, but especially to women. It's so degrading.
Yeah.
To basically devalue a woman based on, you know, her age or to treat her like taking time. Like, I see it so often. Yep. And here's the thing. One of my best friends from college and I were talking about this and, you know, she said that you watch it and, you know, like the journalists and the critics have all been like, there are cringeworthy moments, but there's a reason for that. We all cringe because we've all been like, well, yeah, that's true. We've experienced that. Like, you've experienced the auntie saying you're too dark or, you know, oh, the parent telling like, you know, a 10-year-old daughter, you're a little overweight. Nobody's going to marry you. It's like, fucking A, you're 10 years old. Like, you know, I mean, come on.
Listen, I grew up with that, Srini. I was very dark skinned growing up. You know, I grew up in Karachi. Karachi gets very hot. I was very dark skinned. And my mom used to straight up tell me that to my face. You know, she used to be like, we have to bleach your skin and you have to drink the milk because it's going to make you white. Otherwise, no man is going to marry you. Like,
well, I should introduce you to my friend, Bushra Azhar. She's also Pakistani. She's my podcast guest. She's a badass. Like, she's so cool. She's from Pakistan as well. And I remember like we had her and the guy who was the quote unquote expert on persuasion, and her persuasion explanation was incredible. It was so good. I was like, oh my God.
Yep.
And you know, like I think to me, that's why I think the greater opportunity here than, you know, and like I said, fortunately for me, nobody seems all that interested in my dating life, which I'm actually very happy about because it's giving me a better platform to talk about something I'm far more interested in. Like, somebody had asked on Facebook, like, oh, if there was a season two with you, like as a sort of pseudo Indian bachelor, would you do it? I was like, no, because I don't want to build a career on my relationship status. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to build a career on my craft as a creator. But yeah, there's this is like a very sort of nuanced and rich topic with many layers. And I what I hope is that we finally start having a conversation and continue it that we should have had 20 years ago.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, when I watched the show and I think I later heard from a friend of mine. Actually, I think she might be watching right now. She was actually approached about 2 years ago to appear on the show, and she turned it down. She's a stand-up comic, too. She's yeah. And she turned it down, and we were having this conversation. But one of the things that she told me is that none of the couples that were apparently got together, none of them made it. They all broke up. And but one of the key things that came out of my mouth when I watched the show, first of all, I binge watched it. And one of the key things that just kept going around my head was it's missing humanity. I think that would be.
Yeah, I mean, that's the so, you know, like we did. We just released this episode that, you know, I think I was just telling you about, you know, what happens. Mandy Lynn Cotrone wrote this beautiful memoir called How to Fall in Love with Anyone. And she had a New York Times article that went viral. It was like, you know, ask these 36 questions. So I did it on a first date. And then I had my roommate and his girlfriend record it. And we just aired this today. And it's breathtaking, like to see the depth that takes place when you have this conversation versus the biodata. And you're absolutely right. I like, if I could give one update to how SEMO went about this, I would be like, look, you chose exclusively to look at a person's resume as opposed to who their what their character is. You didn't ask about their values. Like the values portion was like an extracurricular activity. It was like, no, start with that.
That's the core. Like what do you
so here's the thing. Like if you notice the answers when people answered, there's a reason that I think people gravitated towards Nadia so much, because like you look at her answers when she says that, you notice everything she says, not a single one of them lists anything about an occupation, a physical characteristic. They're all very clearly character values, which I think was what was so endearing about her as a character. Like people loved her for that. Yeah. And because it was so like real, it was like, yeah, I mean, of course, like, why wouldn't you, you know? And that's very, very, very magnetic. Like, you know, and the thing is that I'm the weirdo who happens to have this like crazy encyclopedia of human behavior knowledge in my head. So, you know, you do 1,000 interviews with psychologists and, you know, all sorts of people. It's kind of insane what you know that you're like, oh, want to rob a bank? I can tell you how to do that. I know the guy.
Really?
Yeah.
let's be friends. Like, hello, let's do this, Srini. We're in the middle of a pandemic, people. Let's go. I need to pay those bills.
Yeah,
exactly. Let's go buy that house.
And that's the other thing, right? Like, a pandemic created, I think, this just level of sort of resonance in the zeitgeist that I don't think we would have had otherwise. Like, people are all sitting at home, and you know, suddenly it was like, oh, I'm gonna like you binged it, right? Who like. I remember because I think Love is Blind came out right before all this shit went crazy. And I remember watching the first episode and we're like, this is ridiculous. Like my roommate and I were like, and then we went to lunch with two of our really good friends and they were like, oh, and then they like told us and we're like, and I remember texting them like 3 days later. I was like, thanks to you two morons, we just lost 9 hours of our lives. I can't believe you, the smartest people I know, procreated. I'm disappointed in both of you.
I have to kind of go back a little bit and talk about the cringeworthy moments. For me, what I think Nadia is amazing, and I think it's exactly for the reason that you just mentioned and I mentioned about, you know, just that the human aspect of it and just the character traits that she was mentioning. I think for me, one of the cringiest person, if not the most cringiest person on that show is Aparna. And I'll tell you what, I think one of the first things that went through my mind when I watched her, I was just like, how is no one pointing out a therapist to her? How is no one telling her to fucking go to therapy? She's clearly has severe trauma from her parents' divorce. She clearly has some major dad issues. I know it because I had them for a long time. I watched her and I was just like emotionally unavailable, really curt, cannot pick up emotional cues. Her lack of picking up emotional cues was really fascinating to me. I actually wrote this as a Facebook status that if 2020 was a person, it would be up or now.
So that's where the meme started. I was wondering where that came from.
He's a fucking dumpster fire. I'm sorry, Srini. You don't have to say it, but I'll say it on behalf of everyone. She's a goddamn dumpster fire. And her mother is the biggest culprit of it all. Like, you know, it's like sometimes you see people and you're just like, I know what your parents are like. Because you're so fucked up, I think I know exactly where the fuck you got that shit from. And then you, yeah. And the mother sitting right there, you're like, oh, okay, there it is. So that fucked up, then multiplied by 10, and then they got you. Yeah. And I think I was watching her and just basically like the overall show, and I was just like, there is no talk of mental illness. There is no talk of mental health. I mean, Vyasar, whose dad, went to jail, went to prison, and, you know, there's so much trauma there. That trauma has not been processed. That trauma has not been discussed. He's having a hard time even telling that to the date, like, hey, my dad did this, and like, this is kind of my past. Like, he's yeah. having a hard time even reconciling with that. So for me, and that's one of the key, I'm one of the biggest
I think that, look, I as I mentioned to you, like, I at the end of the day, like, one thing, and I've said this in every interview, I said, look, no matter who these people are, at the end of the day, you got to remember behind those avatars are real humans, and that no matter how, you know, you kind of perceive them, the sort of criticism of vitriol, whether it warranted or not, is still very, like, harmful. And I made a point to be like, I don't want any part of that. So yeah. What I will say, I think you brought up a far more interesting topic to me, which is this mental health issue, which yeah. like, look, I'm a guy who's dealt with depression, anxiety, all of that. Yeah. And I think that what you're indicating is the fact that we need to destigmatize mental health in our culture.
Yeah.
Because the stigma around mental health issues in South Asian culture is, I mean, I wrote about it in, you know, the post that I wrote on Medium. That to me is one of the great injustices of how, you know, we raise kids in this culture, and, you know, not just raise kids, like, you know, like, there are people who I'm like, why don't you go to a marriage council? Like, I had a guest who told me once, you know, this one, you know, brilliant woman named Terry Cole. She, you know, is a therapist and also runs, you know, a very popular blog. Yeah. You're talking about boundaries. And she said, yeah, you'd be better suited to spend that money that you spend on this overpriced wedding on, like, marriage counseling. And the funny thing is that, I think it was Zig Ziglar, the motivational speaker, said most people spend more time planning their wedding than they do the marriage.
Yeah.
But again, you know, you brought up a good point in that, like, we as a culture need to destigmatize mental health. You know, like I said, I have no interest in, you know, talking about anybody's character, because, like, plenty of people are doing that already.
I'm a stand-up comic, Shreen. I get off.
I'm not judging you, just so we're clear. Like, but I also know that I don't want to add fuel to that fire. So look, here's the thing. I have nothing bad to say about any of these people. They feel what they feel. Like, that's what it is, right? That's dating in general. Like, sometimes you match with somebody, you don't. Do I think it was, you know, unnecessarily harsh towards me or, you know, like, tactless? Yes. But the thing is, beyond that, I don't, you know, people had, you know, contacted me on Twitter. I was like, oh, you know, how did you feel? And I was like, for a moment or two, I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, as my roommates, I was like, I know that's not true, so it doesn't matter to me. I'm like, I have, you know, plenty of other stuff going on in my life that adds value to it, that this doesn't matter. Because the other problem is, like, I used to do this. We, you know, particularly in dating context, one of the things that we're guilty of is we will take one person's opinion and turn that into a universal truth. It's like, oh, one girl doesn't like you. It's like, oh, girls don't like me. Like, that, I mean, I know I did this for my whole life. It was like, oh, that girl doesn't like me, so all girls don't like me. Like, you take individual opinions and turn them into universal truths, which honestly is so detrimental. And that's, like, more than anything, a self-worth issue.
My therapist this week gave me this chart. It's genius. And it's exactly what you just said, which is, like, you take one wrong thing and you magnify it. And there's, like, and it's called unhelpful thinking styles. So whenever I get in those modes, she asks me to go and check in with myself and see which category it falls in, and then basically break the pattern. So it's pretty amazing. And so that whole thing you were talking about, that's the all or thinking, all or nothing thinking. Oh, one girl doesn't like me, then all girls don't like me. And she has that up here. It's friggin' amazing. But it's, like, super helpful. But no, I 100% agree with you. I think, you know, look, I have family members who have pretty serious mental health issues. I myself suffer from depression, anxiety, and insomnia, and that's a pretty ongoing thing. I've been in therapy for 13 years. I'm very proud of it. I'm a huge advocate of it. I tell my family members to go to therapy. There's a lot of trauma in our family, so we try to process that.
You should check out our, not to, you know, plug my own work, but we did an interview on generational trauma with this guy, Mark Wolin. Like, a girl that I was, you know, went on a couple of days with, recommended this book to me, and it was mind blowing how healing that book was. Like, I'd never gotten that much out of a book. And you what actually, it's called It Didn't Start With You.
It didn't, or they didn't?
It didn't start with you.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I'm going to download it tonight.
it's a worthwhile read. Like you'll be, I'll send you the podcast that you can share with your listeners. But that was a really eye-opening conversation. Like I got a lot from that, because one of the things he makes you do as an exercise in the book is like a generational trauma map. Like he has a, you know, sort of language and framework to figure it out. But like I had this incredibly like just deep fear that I was going to die alone. You know, and that it was funny because I mean, you get to my age and you're single, like, in some ways, like, okay, maybe that fear is warranted. But the thing is, like, if you go into every situation with that fear, then you're kind of screwed right from the start. And what I realized was that that actually wasn't mine, but I'd seen it happen all around me. And I never processed it consciously. Like, I knew it had all happened. But when I actually mapped it out, it was like, holy crap, this is amazing. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, just get ready for a week that will be like an emotional root canal. But a well worthwhile one.
Okay. I'm a fan of root canals, but,
I don't know anybody who is.
I don't know anybody. Yeah, that's true. Listen, I'm all about anything that brings, spiritual growth, self growth, self awareness. I'm like all about that. I'm absolutely all about that. I want to know, first of all, did your family knew you were going to do this, and what were their kind of thoughts watching their son or their brother up there?
My family knew, and I think that, so the first night I watched it, I was like really livid because I was like, Seema called me a loser? What? You know, and then my mom called me back the next day. She's like, no, that's not what happened. We watched it closely. She's like, and I was like, I mean, the thing is like, it dropped at midnight on, Thursday, California time. And my roommate and his girlfriend were going on a camping trip. So like, no, dude, we're not waiting till Sunday. We have to. And so they woke me up at 1 a.m. to watch it. I think they were even more interested than I was. I was like, look, I'm like, you guys are going to be back on Sunday. We'll watch it together. And so we did. And it was, my parents, I think, were very happy that like I carried myself the way I did. They're like, good. We taught you well. We're happy that you showed up the way that you did. And, you know, people have asked if I felt that I was unfairly portrayed, and I was like, no, I was portrayed incredibly accurately. The opinion somebody has is not the same thing as my portrayal. Everything I said was, I was like, this is who I am unapologetically. I'm a surfer, snowboarder, skier. And you know what? I had a life plan. It didn't work. So I'm not interested in having one anymore, because guess what? Pandemics fuck up life plans. I'm sure everybody had a life plan. Yeah. How many of them are actually living according to it?
Right, Trini. You know what they say? You want to make God laugh? You make plans. That's how you make God laugh.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, look, I had this unusual realization early in my life because I graduated twice into recessions. And so to come to that realization at 20 something, to be like, oh, I can make all the plans in the world and it doesn't matter, because, you know, like I gave a speech to my high school AP English teachers graduating class, and it was baffling to me how many, you know, seniors in high school were so worried about what they're going to do with their lives. And I was like, you've barely lived any of your life to even consider what you want to do. You're in high school. Like, high school is such a like limited experience. And yep. So to me, you know, I've lived this life where I've gotten to collect a lot of data points. I think that has been one of the really remarkable gifts that's come from this, is that if you look at people who find passions in their life, things that just don't feel like work, the kinds of things that lead to flow. I mean, for you, it has to be stand-up comedy, where you don't feel like you're doing work. Like, the reason you do this, yeah, the accolades are nice. Yeah, all that. But the truth is that the best thing I ever heard about commercial success in the arts is that being successful creatively and commercially, what that does is it gives you the opportunity to keep doing your work.
That's right.
Like, it just extends the lifeline. And that's all I think, you know, most of us deep down really want. Because look, the moments in the spotlight, even if your name is on the bestseller list a week from now, you'll be forgotten. Look, 6 months from now, nobody's going to give two shits about Indian matchmaking or me, you know, other than my listeners who have been with me for 10 years. Like, they won't. I mean, it's just the reality. It's hot in the zeitgeist now because we're all sitting at home, you know, watching it. I mean, not even 6 months. Like, think about it this way. This is something I use as an example. Think about the most viral video on YouTube last week. I guarantee you, people who thought it was the hottest thing since sliced bread last week don't even remember it this week, because that's what our culture is like. And so you cannot base any of what your fulfillment is on external validation, because it's temporary. know, you, and so that to me is really kind of the neat thing. So I've never felt that I was unfairly portrayed. I was incredibly accurately portrayed, and I'm really glad I was, because I'm now getting to meet people like you.
Yeah. I mean, you know what it is, Shani, like, I was watching, I think the two people besides you, Nadia, and that guy Shaker from Chicago, he really stood out to me too. He also had like this real cool, like, vulnerability to him, and he was very like honest, and he was just very open, and I really liked it. He's the one who like Nadia had a date, and apparently, and then they broke it up apparently. I feel, do you think that this show has not only look, it's gotten a lot of backlash. Also, people are, it's cringeworthy moments, it's colorism, classism, all the other thing, and casteism and all that stuff. But do you also feel like it also, maybe because it's now out in the open and now the Western world knows about how the real shit, the way it goes down, do you think like things will change?
That would be the optimal outcome in my mind. And I hope that, you know, like, I've not read all the interviews that Smriti did about, you know, producing. Like, I've looked at a lot of the coverage, and I think that that's what she was really aiming for, was to start a conversation, which, like, is what a good documentary filmmaker does. Mm-hmm. I don't think her intention at all was to create any sort of drama, like to create this, but it, you know, I mean, she did something incredibly important in culture that we needed to have happen, because what she did is she gave voice to something that we as South Asians have buried under the rug. I mean, like, the only other people who have honestly come close are people like Mira Nair and people like Jhumpa Lahiri, who have tackled topics that you're like, ooh, like, you're messing with that? Like, and that's why I think what I think is so remarkable about Mira Nair as a filmmaker is she's willing to go attack topics that we really don't want to talk about because they're so taboo, yet they're necessary. Like, we're not going to change any of what is wrong, you know, by burying it under the rug. And I think that that's what this did, is it ignited, you know, this conversation that's been long overdue. You know, like I said, we should have had this conversation 20 years ago. And the fact that we've already had, like, I don't know, you know, how old you are, but like, look, I've had a generation of friends who've gone through college and are having kids.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have taken till now for that to happen. Now, keep in mind, like, everything was really different in, you know, the early 90s. Like, at that time, you know, my parents' advice, go to college or you're going to have a shit life, was actually pretty valid. Unfortunately, that's being dismantled before our eyes, thanks to, you know, tuition costs and a whole bunch of other bullshit that, like, is well beyond the scope of this conversation. But the thing that you know, we have to realize is that what we've done here is we've started probably the most important conversation South Asians have had in generations. Like, because what is the South Asian way of being in the world, unfortunately, is one of conformity and silence.
Yes.
Like, and you know, and I honestly, I think the people who get it worst are women.
Yes.
You know, look, I mean, no matter, you know.
Yes,
I should allow, you know.
I know a thing or two about that.
Yeah, I mean, and look, I'm saying this as a guy. So one of my friends interviewed me for her podcast, and her opening question is, what do you like most about being a man? Which is already a loaded question. Like, I was like, oh God. But I told her, I said, look, if I had the choice between being my age and a South Asian male and single, and my age and a South Asian female and single, I would choose male every single time, because we have such a double standard for that, you know? It's so ridiculous. Yeah, like, I've seen, you know, 40-year-old women who are like breathtakingly beautiful, and I'm like, why are you treating her like she's a ticking time bomb? I'm like, and the problem they don't think about is, oh, so it's better for her to get married early, end up in an unhappy marriage, get divorced, and, you know, like, for you to pick up the pieces later than maybe wait. Like, I think I was telling a friend the other day, I was like, you know what? I'd rather have 30 amazing years with somebody than 60 average ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, much the dismay of every Indian auntie who probably is hearing this or seeing this. Like,
yeah. Damn those aunties. Damn the matchmaking aunties. I had a matchmaker approach my mom. I was 17. The guy was 40, Pakistani doctor in Boston. And apparently my mom, without my consent, had sent my picture over, which is kind of like borderline pedophilic. Sent my picture over. And this dude was like, I'll tap that. I hit that. My mom got back to me, and I remember very specifically coming back from high school. My mom sat me down, and she's like, you are going to swear on the Quran that you are going to do something for me. And I was like, I'm not swearing on nothing. What the fuck is going on? And she was like, well, there's this doctor in Boston and he saw your picture. I'm like, how old is she? She's like 40. At 17, 40 sounds like 80, you know, because like it's just a, such a vast gap.
Of course.
That time, you know, you haven't even hit 18. And I remember just being like, I want nothing to do with this. I just want to live my life. I just want to pursue my things that I want to. And which brings me to the point that you just made about a life of conformity, right? There was this one guy, what's his name? Akshay, who was a personality of a celery. He's on there. He's in Mumbai. And his mom, they're very uber wealthy, clearly very privileged. And his mom said something that really just hit me right in the heart. And she said, you know, she's like, he has too much freedom. And I was like, whoa, there it is.
Choosing a life partner is a place where you should have ultimate freedom. I mean, so let's think about that. You know, like you may have seen the survey I put on Facebook, like I'm working on a blog post about what are the five most important decisions we make in our lives. And who you marry literally shows up in every single answer. I was like, yeah,
it will be the number one thing, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, it literally, well, here's the thing. Like what I was trying to do is figure out, because, you know, every decision you make has an impact on your destiny. Like what you decide to do today could impact what your life looks like tomorrow, the day after. Like the fact that I decided, you know, 10 years ago that, you know what, to hell with it, I'm going to like try to start this thing instead of look for a job. I'm here because of like a decision I made 10 years ago on one day. And, you know, but the thing is, like, there are certain decisions that this is what I'm looking for. That's in, you know, looking at these answers, is there are probably five decisions that I think have a disproportionate impact on all the other things that happen in your life. Who you marry is one of them.
Yes.
And like, I'm sorry, but if you fuck that up, the damage that's done from that is so traumatic for people. Yeah. Like, I know, I mean, it's, people lose money, they lose lives. I mean, it's not one of those things that you should take lightly just because you're on some quote unquote timeline. It's ridiculous. And that's my biggest like issue with the way that we go about all of this. Like like you said, I was like, they're pretty much, I think anybody's reaction when they're seeing one on screen is like, what the fuck is that guy doing there? How did he end up here? You know? And
I didn't, those were not my thoughts.
Right. But you know what I mean?
For me, like the moment I saw you, and I saw you sitting in that house, I was just like, I was like, he does not in the slightest fit their whatever fucked up mold that they have. I was like, he does not fit in that. I was like, he is the most non-traditional guy that they could have possibly invited into the house. And this is just not, my honest opinion, I saw that and I was like, he's too good for her. I was like,
thank you. That's really sweet. But
I was like, he's too good for her. I was like, mainly because I think for me, Shuni, because you and I are both outliers, right? We're outliers. We do not follow. We did not follow the drum and the beat of what our culture had dictated to us. We marched to the beat of our own drum. And I think for a lot of Desis, that's not an easy task to do. I mean, there's a price to pay. I continue to pay a very big price for it. You continue to pay a price for it, right? We don't have like, you know, my brothers and I, we talk, and my brothers are IT guys, you know, and business owners and stuff. And they live very, very kind of like that very kind of traditional life, married with kids. They live in Texas. They have that whole lifestyle, you know, and they look at me as a fucking weirdo. But the craziest thing is that I look at them as a fucking weirdo. Possibly, and I'm just like, no, you're the weirdo. You're weird. Like, why would you have all this freedom given to you in America, and that's what you chose? Like, why would you walk down that path?
Well, let me just make one comment on that. It goes back to that thing I said about opportunity cost, right? Like, each of these things have their own upsides and own downsides. Like, you and I get to do like really cool work, but sometimes it, you know, it comes at the cost of a lot of other things. Like it, you know, I mean, look, if you choose the path that we have, like certain things become harder. It, you know, you're delayed in doing things like settling down and starting a family. And that's inevitable. You know, it's not that they can't both work together. But it creates challenges. And so I think that that's the one thing that really, you know, to me is really, it's an opportunity to understand values. And sometimes, and that's why even, you know, going through this whole blog post research, like the next question I'm going to post is, okay, what, because you look at values, and I was writing about this morning, I've been thinking about this, is that like our first sort of initial set of values come from, you know, our parents, like they're the people around. So they instill what they believe are values that we should have. Then what happens is you go out and you experience life. And as you collect data points, you start to suddenly see, oh, well, maybe I don't value, you know, what they say I should. Like, you realize at a certain point that your values and theirs aren't necessarily aligned. Now, does that make your brothers and, you know, choices bad per se? No, like, I'm sure your brothers are amazing people. Like, I'm sure you look for them, you know, and I'm sure like you love hanging out with them. Like, I mean, I love my sister, like, you know, and I think she's the most badass human being in the world. I mean, she's like a totally crazy, you know.
My brothers don't feel that way about me. Yeah.
Well, you know, my sister is amazing. Like, I think she's like, you know, superhuman. Like, I always feel like, oh, well, I'm like, you're in a room with my sister. I can promise you she is the smartest person in the room. Like, this is the girl who at 4 years old went to NASA. And when this engineer told her that the atomic clock goes wrong every 400 years, she was like, how do you know? And the guy said, well, somebody told me. And she's like, do you believe everything other people tell you? A 4 year old. Yeah, you know, so at that point, we're like, we got no chance against her. She is hands down the smartest person in the room, no matter what room it is. Like, but yeah, I mean, like, and her life choices dictate, you know, very clearly aligned with the values. Like, my parents love the fact that she became a doctor. I think it took me a long time, took my parents a long time to accept that, oh, wow, okay, what we're dealing with is something very different with our son, and he's not going to fit this mold no matter how hard we try. Mm-hmm. I think that...
Wait. What did you just put in your mouth? Can't just be started chewing and not
paleo bar. We're trying to be healthy. It's not really, this is like our close, like,
dude, that is the most Cali thing you can pull right now.
We're eating like naans and, you know, carbs, and we were all gaining a lot of weight. It was bad.
And your point is,
that
it's the pandemic, Srini. I got the pandemic body, man. Why do you think we're wearing this giant fucking shirt just to look like a
mink? Look, I don't want to have a pandemic body, because when snowboarding season starts, I need to be able to get back on the mountain. So I'm not.
That is, if we get the vaccine, are they? Is it open? Can you get back
no. up there? Well, now it's summer, so no. But no, I mean, look, that's, you know, like, part of it is like, I know the way that I eat affects the way that I work, so that's a big part of it.
Sure.
And just to reassure you, we have a massive order of Indian food coming with like naans and all the other good stuff. Like, so this is just to hold me over until, because this is late in the day for me. So
is this tonight that this is happening?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And how are you going to throw that at me right now? I throw that at me right now. Now I want naan and desi food tonight. Are you based in California? Where are you?
Not anymore. I moved to Colorado in January of this year. Mainly because a lot of my good friends are here. That was actually the big reason. Some of my best friends are here. And, you know, I realized, like, social connection, like, you know, the people that you're with make a world of difference. And I just happen to have the greatest roommates in the world. Like, I've never had, like, I'm the happiest I've been in my adult life in terms of a living situation. We're just having such a blast. I mean, because we're all entrepreneurs, we're all goofballs. Like, we all kind of work well together. Like, we just have a really nice chemistry.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, we've just kind of, I mean, it's we're at the point where, like, I can't imagine, like, these are the people that are going to speak at my wedding type of thing. That's like how close we've become in this time. And I think that's been the really kind of the blessing in disguise from this shit show we call, you know, a presidency and a pandemic.
What a fucked up shit that's happening. Here's a question, Srini. Ever since you've, now that the show is out, how many girls are hitting you up, and how many nudes are you getting on the regs? Let's just talk.
Okay. Look, this is a really, so as you might imagine, a lot. Okay.
Yeah,
And I was briefly in the show, but the thing is, I'm probably the one who had the most substantial public presence up until that point. Mm-hmm. Granted, Nadia is way more likable than I am. Like, everybody loves her for good reason. But the thing is, like, I had this massive body of work behind me. Yeah. But yeah, a lot, to the point where it's kind of like overwhelming. You don't really know what to make of it. But I'm also extremely wary of getting involved with people who find out about me through something I've done in the public eye. Because it goes back to that whole projection thing. It's like, I think you're actually going to be disappointed if you hang out with me, because I'm not going to live up to whatever, you know, fucked up perception you have of who I am. There's just no way. I know, because I've experienced it before. Like, I spent 6 months in therapy dissecting this, and it's the thing is, like, I'm very mindful of it. It's kind of flirting with disaster, because that's how careers like mine go down the tubes. And I know, because I almost ran, you know, Unmistakable into the ground 4 years ago because of it. And so I'm very gun shy about it. Don't get me wrong, it's super flattering. Like, I mean, what guy wouldn't like all that attention? Like, you'd have to be, you know, somebody who's insane if you didn't, you know. It's like, look, it's like the weird thing is, imagine going from being a guy who was insecure about women your entire life to suddenly getting more validation than you've ever had. So, and yet you also know deep down that it's all just a house of cards. It's not real, you know, because at the end of the day, like, the people that matter are the people that are close to you. They know who you are. They're the ones who will accept you in your darkest hours and your most fucked up moments. And they'll, you know, forgive, you know, every inadequacy you have, which I have lots of. So, yeah, I mean, it's weird, you know. Like, I got to say, I wasn't quite ready for the onslaught. Like, until you messaged me, I hadn't seen the spam messages inside of Facebook, because I didn't realize they were there. And I was like, holy shit, there was like 100 of them. And I'm like, all right, cool. But I mean, you know, I think that I've also been very mindful of making sure that I treat it as an opportunity to like have people discover my work rather than, you know, you know, because the thing is, you have to, in a situation like this, like, I mean, you had one strange phone call with an auntie, and I was like, Dad, I'm fucking done. I'm like, you can send anybody you guys want me to talk to. My cousin, she's the only person I'm going to talk to from now on. I want her to be the gatekeeper if this is of any interest to you. So I need everything filtered through her, because I trust her judgment implicitly.
Yeah.
And, you know, because of that, I mean, she was like, you know, where are you at with all this? I'm a person who quit social media for 90 days. Like, I don't like using social media. I find it, this has been the most distracting 2 weeks I've ever had. And, you know, this is I'm very much a proponent of like deep work, like very little presence on social. Like, if you go and look at my Facebook feeds prior to this week, you won't see anything after January, until this week. Mainly, you know, I think I put a documentary that I made about the women of my family up, but that's it. You know, because I'm a writer, like, it takes a lot of concentration and focus to do what I do. In interviews. So like, I find it all to me, it's an entertaining distraction, and it's kind of like the most awful, the most evil distraction of all, because it's a combination of social media and validation from women. Like, that's a landmine if there ever was one.
Wait a minute. You can't just skip over the fact you got hundreds of messages coming.
Hundreds. Look, I don't know how many there are. I didn't like just, you know, sit around counting. But again, like I said, I mean, I think to me, I also
beating them away with a stick over here.
Look, I mean, I have been tried to be very mindful of the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, I am still somebody who has a public presence, and in the public eye, everything I do has the potential to turn into a crisis. You know, that's scary, you know, especially when you've worked so hard to build what you have. Yeah. That's just not worth the risk of the kind of crisis that this could all cause. Like I said, it's flattering. It's nice. Yeah. And the truth be told, like, the messages have all been very, very sweet. You know, and I'm, you know, like, everybody's like, oh, I have a cousin I want to set you up with. It's just, you know, it's hilarious. It's entertaining, but, you know, at the same time, like, I think,
you haven't taken a single offer that was thrown at you, Shani?
I don't think so. No. So, you know, my sister introduced me to somebody through a friend of hers that I was like, you know, willing to have a conversation with, but that's about it. You know, I mean, people are, I mean, I'm also in Colorado, so it's like, okay, I'm like, you're where? I'm like, sorry, not going to happen, but I will absolutely go out and have a drink with you, because you just seem so cool when this thing ends and you're in SoCal. So when I come to visit my parents, we should definitely hang out. And I would love to meet your other stand-up comedian friends, because those are my kind of weirdos.
I'll take you to a bunch of clubs and all my shows. I actually have, I started 5 years ago. I started my brand called Minority Reports, and I made history by being the first brown person ever to have produced a successful comedy show at the world famous Comedy Store, which is where your Robin Williams and all your legendary Bill Hicks and all they all started there. And I was very fortunate enough to get a comedy show there. So now I took that show and I turned it into a nationally touring comedy show. Now that's turned into a TV show. That's also a podcast digital series. So I've just been doing, like, I've been working a lot, I've been hustling. So I think that one of the things that I'm really pissed off about 2020 is the fact that I put in about 100-hour weeks last year, pretty much throughout all of 12 months. And I was like, oh, fuck yeah, come 2020, I'm going to be reaping the rewards. And 2020 is like, fuck you, Mana. Fuck you. You get nothing.
Well, I mean, I think the great thing about that, though, is it shows, like, the work ethic that is actually involved in this. Because I think people, one of my friends was like, people want what you have. They just don't want to do what they need to do in order to get it.
Yep. People don't see the sacrifice, right? They don't see the sacrifice.
They only see the result. It doesn't matter who it is, right? Because you don't hear about somebody like we were watching this movie Crazy People last night with Dudley Moore. And I was like, Matthew Perry is in this movie? Holy shit. I had no idea. Like, and that movie is like 30 years old, long before Friends. You know?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, you don't hear about anybody until, you know, they suddenly appear in the spotlight. You're like, oh, this happened overnight. And it's like, go dig deeper. And it's like, no. I'm like, go, you know, like, there's a really great interview on Off Camera with Hasan Minhaj, and he talks about how he drove from his parents' house in Sacramento to, you know, SF every night, you know, until he crashed the car and they found out. And so, like, you look at that and you're like, wow, that's what it took. Even when he did his audition for The Daily Show,
yeah,
he didn't actually audition. He actually sent a fully done segment as one of their correspondents.
Oh, wow. It's funny talking about Hasan. So Hasan and I, this is like, I think 6 months before he got The Daily Show. So Hasan and I are standing at the Comedy Store in the hallway where a lot of the comics stand and chit chat and watch other comics. And me and Hasan are standing there and I'm looking at Hasan and I'm like, hey, man, I'm a New York comic. Like, I'm a New Yorker. Like, I moved out to LA. I'm not so sure. Maybe I made the wrong choice. You know, maybe I should have just stayed. And he goes, no, Mona, don't say that. He's like, there's a lot of good opportunities here. You just got to be patient. You just got to stay focused, you know? You got to stay focused. And then 6 months later, he ended up – and by the way, I think after Hasan got that, I auditioned for The Daily Show also. But there can only be one Muslim, Shrini.
Here's the thing. The fact that you made it to the point in your career where you actually are auditioning for The Daily Show, that's fucking impressive. Like, I – bow down to you, you know, hats off to you. Like, to me, that's impressive. Like, I haven't come close to that. You know, it's like,
I'm not a public author.
Well, no, I mean, I have a deep appreciation for the work that comedians do, because you do what I do in a speaking gig, but every day, like, you know, and the amount of energy that takes and the amount of work that it takes to do that. I've always, like, you know, admired what goes into that. Like, I, you know, people are like, who's your, like, I, you know, one of the things I've been wanting to do is two types of podcasters. One is an interview, a series on Indians of the Art. And, like, Hasan is at the top of that list. Like, I want to do him, Jhumpa Lahiri. Because I had this idea, like, a few years ago, we did an entire month where we interviewed nothing but women and the podcast growth skyrocketed. And I asked one of my friends, she's like, I was like, why did that happen? She's like, because women talk to each other. And I was like, holy shit. I'm like, well, Indians talk to each other way more. Like, they're as connected as it gets. I was like, if I did an entire month of Indian guests, I wonder what would happen to the show. So, like, I'm working on that right now to kind of figure out how to get that done. But
that sounds pretty amazing. And I think,
well, I mean, and of course, strategic, right? Like, with the timing of everything that's going on, I think having and the other thing is to give voice to Indian artists and to show Indian models of possibility who've done the kinds of things that, you know, like, people perceive me to have done, you know, on the show. So.
Yep. I mean, look, we are seeing in some unprecedented amount of Indians and some Pakistanis in politics than ever before. I mean, Jayapal is up there, like, putting putting Barr in place. Did you see that? Jayapal was, like, going after Barr the other day, just, like, putting him in his place, letting him know, like, hey, this is not, you can't interrupt me. You can't take my time away. This is not how this shit works. So it was. I think for you, interviewing politicians would be an amazing thing to do too.
Yeah. No. I mean, I've gotten to interview Andrew Yang and you know, a few other people. So that's been cool. Like, I've had a few White House staffers, which has been great.
Do the math. Do the math, Trini. Do the math. Andrew Yang. I was like, dude, that is the most Asian slang he could have possibly come up with. Do the math. It's like a Desi person running for office and saying, learn to spell. It's like, holy shit, spelling bees are jammed, son. Like, what? Yes, you do the math and we'll do the spelling and this is all going to come together. Shrini, what are you working on a new book now? What's going on with you?
Books and me are this, like, love-hate relationship right now, because I spent a year working on a proposal and my agent was like, no go. And I was like, really? After a year? And so I was like, ah, whatever. But she just didn't feel that it was like unique enough or, you know, had enough of an angle that would really resonate with a publisher. You know, like my books have been sort of slow burns. Like they are kind of slow. They've been sort of, luckily they've continued to sell, but I wasn't like sort of, you know, Mark Manson level, Ryan Holiday, you know, sort of instant New York Times bestseller. And so, you know, that becomes a harder sell because look, I mean, you're a comedian, you know, at the end of the day, no matter how much people tell you, it's like all about the art. It's like, no, at the end of the day, everything here is about making money. They're all businesses too, you know?
Listen, like, they don't call it show. They call it show business.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, like a publishing company is a business. Like this is why when I talk to aspiring authors, I was like, you might have the greatest idea in the world, but if it's not commercially viable, it doesn't matter. You know, like it baffles me when people think that. It's like I've been sitting around writing a novel in isolation for 5 years. I was like, yeah, with no audience or anything. Like it's so rare for that to happen. But so as far as books go, like an idea that I've kind of tossed, you know, put out there to see what the sort of conversation would be around it. And I put it on Facebook. You saw is like, what about a book about immigrants in the arts? Because I think I'm very uniquely qualified to actually do that because I happen to be in that role. Yeah. I interviewed a lot of artists and I think that I can give voice to something that a lot of people are feeling. I mean, I'm the kid whose dad wisely talked out of being a music major. I don't regret that. He was like tuba players or dime a dozen. I would have been reading obituaries for jobs. And so that is, you know, one of those things that to me, that would be an interesting subject. I would write a book on that. But then, you know, if you read a lot of Robert Greene and 50 Cent, you start to become somewhat sociopathic of, oh, why would I do that when I don't own every aspect of it? You know, like, why would I give somebody that much power when I could do it myself? Because I have the audience. Like, I could do it all on my own. I could do it faster. I could self-publish it. But I'll tell you what that process of doing it with a publisher gives you is an incredible amount of accountability, discipline, and the ability to just go through something over and over and over and over to the point where you really want to just shoot yourself and you're like, oh, but the thing is, at the end of the day, what you get is a breathtaking product. Like, I was so proud of my books. Like, they made me work with a writing coach. And they're like, we're afraid that you are a good writer, but you can't structure your ideas in a linear fashion. And I was like, yeah, that's a valid concern. It's true. That's why I never wrote a book until now. And my writing coach, I mean, I had to give her, you know, a decent chunk of my advance, not like a ton, but a substantial amount. That was worth every penny because I don't think my books would have been nearly as good without her. Like that was one of those things. She taught me how to really sit down and construct arguments, support everything I said with evidence. You know, I mean, writing nonfiction books is, you know, not the sort of thing where you can just say whatever the hell you want and not back it up.
That's right.
With, you know, real evidence. And then so, but the idea of immigrants in the arts is something that I mean, I'm going to email my agent and ask her about it. I just don't anticipate, I'm not going to spend any time on it if it doesn't, you know, lead. Because the thing is, like, building the podcast is my intellectual property. Whereas I'm not dependent on anybody to do that. I can continue to do that. And anybody who, you know, you look at this through a pure business lens, right? Writing a book would give me a temporary windfall. And yeah. Continuing to grow the podcast to the point where a million people are listening, well, that sets me up for life. You know, there's a big difference. Yeah, it doesn't have the immediate payoff. It's like 50 Cent said in his book. It was like, you know, you don't want to judge opportunities based on the immediate payoff, but look at them based on their long-term potential. Right. And, you know, 4 years ago, writing books with a publisher was incredibly good for my long-term potential. Yeah. Right now, I have investors. Increasing the valuation of my company is way better for my long-term potential than potentially writing a book. Like a book could become a very big distraction.
Sure.
You know, granted, I'm capable of juggling multiple projects.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, granted, we're in a pandemic, so it's not like I have anything to fucking do. So I could write a book.
You know. That's why I got into stand-up, just the long-term returns on it, getting paid in drink tickets. And doing about 4 minute four minute set in the middle of a laundromat at midnight. That's why I got into stand-up comedy, just that stability that it was going to give me. I'm a former finance girl, man. I used to work on the trading floor in New York City. I was one of the four women who worked on the trading floor. Okay, I mean, my family's like, how the fuck are you going to leave this to get into stand up, like, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, I wanted stability. You know, in 2008, when the market crashed, I was there. I worked for Citibank. I worked for Citigroup. I remember watching standing in my building. A city had left, and I remember watching Lehman Brothers and everybody at Lehman Brothers pack their stuff and leave right in front of my eyes. I remember that when they locked the doors. I remember that. I was there for the market crash. And I think that was one of my biggest things. And I think for me also, I think I had the freedom because I had already moved out by then. I was married for about 9.5 years. I had already gone through my divorce. So at this point, I was just like, I can do whatever the fuck I want. I answer to nobody. Like, this is all me. And I think it's also a very scary place because, you know, just like we were talking about earlier, like our culture tells us to conform, right? Everything is about conforming and just following the narrow path and just very being, you know, just following this path. That's it. There's no kind of outside thing. Don't have too many options. Don't have too many options, right? And I think for me, for the first time in my life, I was just like, I can go butt naked streaking in the middle of the night on the street and nobody can say shit to me. And I was like, this is the amount of freedom that I have and I can do. And I chose comedy. That's what I chose from all of it. What do you think is going to happen, you know, as far as like the generation that's going to come after us? I mean, look, I'm an immigrant. You're not an immigrant. You were born and raised here, right?
No, I was born in India.
Oh, you were? How old were you?
Yeah. So I lived all over the world, Australia, Canada, Texas in here.
How old were you when your family moved out from India?
Oh, I mean, I was only there for 3 months. So technically, like, you know.
So you kind of grew up on a plane.
Yeah, I mean, that's and, you know, all over the world. Like, I mean, I always say my parents, you know, get mad that I want to stay in one place. I was like, you dragged me around the world for my entire childhood, and now you're shocked I want to see more of it. That's your fault, not mine.
Right. You went to Berkeley?
I did.
What did you go to school for?
Economics.
Is that what did you want to be when you were like about 8-9 years old? Did you know what you wanted to be? That did you have an idea?
I didn't actually. I was just, you know, like whatever my parents wanted to be. There were, you know, periods where I wanted to be a doctor, but only because I saw doctors lived in big houses and drove Mercedes. Like, that was the only reason I ever wanted to be a doctor.
Got it. And then what made you kind of deter from it as you got older?
Life experience. You know, like I wasn't good at science. I wasn't good at math. I wasn't good at anything Indian people are supposed to be.
What kind of a dissy are you? Not
very disgraceful one.
Science? What?
Yeah.
Spelling bee contest, Trini? Or what are we looking at here?
No, I got eliminated in the first round of the spelling bee, which is disgraceful. Like, that's disgraceful. That's like the ultimate low.
The true outlier. That's how we do it. It's I think what you have represented to me, you know, for desi men and how desi men are always like, oh, you know, you have to have your career and you have to make X amount of money and own a house and have this car and have all this shit together in order to have like some hot, attractive wife that's going to walk into your life. And then you're going to be like this perfect couple and have these perfect kids. And for me, you just came in and you brought in a sledgehammer in many ways to me, and you just shattered every last bit of that bullshit ass stereotype. And honestly, kudos to you for doing that.
Thank you. That to me is like the supreme compliment. If I've managed to do that, then that to me is a massive success.
Yeah, because I saw you and I was just like, ha ha, this guy. I was like, oh my God, they're gonna, he does not fit into their bullshit ass construct, whatever they have. And I love the fact that you came and shattered it. So are you going to go back? Are they going to invite you back or something? Is that how this works, or how does
I couldn't tell you, but you know, it's kind of, as I joked with you earlier, like some people are like, do you want to be a life coach? I was like, fuck no. And I honestly don't have any particular interest in building a career out of my relationship status. Like, it's just not what I want to be known for.
Yeah.
I want to spend time, you know, on my craft. Like, that to me is the great gift that came from this is that a lot of people know about my creative work. And like, I plan to pour more energy into that. Like, you know, I mean, would I, you know, chime in on the experience if they're like, hey, can we do a video segment with you? I'd be like, yes. But do I want to go through the sort of matchmaking experience again? No, not really. I don't think it's, you know,
a few years ago, I was invited to be part of the Millionaire Matchmaker. You remember Patty Stanger?
Mm-hmm.
Millionaire Matchmaker on Bravo. Remember that show? I don't know if you remember that show. Yeah. I was invited to be on that show. I went on audition for it. I must have been smoking something really bad. And then I walked out and I was like, never. Oh my God. I was like, if they call me, I'm just not gonna. And they kept calling me. They called me like 3 times. And they were like, Patty would love to for you to be on the show. And I was like, no, thank you. And it just so happened that weekend, I forget what dating app I was. And I right swiped on this guy who was a chef. And apparently the guy I was supposed to be on the show with was also a chef. And turns out that was the guy who was going to be on that show on Millionaire Matchmaker. He was the bachelor. And then they were talking to him, and we were just like making fun of the show. And I was like, is it not just a pot of crock? And he was like, yeah, it is. It's just bullshit. It's all scripted. How much of it was scripted for you, Srini? Is there any script involved?
No, not at all. It was exactly what you saw. Like, I mean, I don't know what happens in editing, but pretty much everything you saw was what happened. That's all I remember. Nothing about it was scripted.
So did you know the executive producer to get in the show, or how did you?
I was introduced through a friend. That's pretty much how it all went down, for a friend that I went to college with.
Oh, and yeah. He's Indian? Is your college?
No. It was, she is Indian. She just happened to know the producers.
Oh, wow. And they were like, hey, you'd be good for it. And so when you first met them, did you have to send in a video or did you go meet them in person?
No, I think I just talked to them on the phone or something. I think part of it is I already had a lot of, you know, sort of stuff online publicly. So they kind of like, oh, okay, this guy can pull his own on camera. We're not, you know, worried about that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so you're working on the book. And can you talk a little bit more about your podcast and what exactly is it?
Yeah. Absolutely. So basically, you know, as I was talking about it at the beginning, Unmistakable Creative is really, I think one of our listeners summed it up as TED Talks meets Oprah, which was like the most flattering compliment. It's like, oh, okay, two like massive things that everybody loves. But, you know, I think we do really a deep dive into a person's story, like who they are as a person, but then also manage to blend it with what their knowledge or expertise is. In a way that our listeners walk away from it feeling like they've just learned, you know, so much. I mean, people use the content to homeschool their kids. People use it for therapy. I mean, the applications of this are mind-boggling to me. I just, things that I would have never expected. But yeah, I mean, we could do an entire follow-up episode about just that, which, you know, like, because I'm literally 30 minutes away from having to get ready for a dinner. So
that's cool, Trini. No, we're going to wrap up. I know that you have to run off, and I've already cut into your happy hour time.
No worries. All good. I've really enjoyed chatting with you. So
no, thank you. Same here. Yeah. We'll definitely do a follow-up, and, yeah, whenever you're in Cali, let's have, or at least we can have like a social distance drink or something.
Yeah.
You know, cool. So where can we find you, Srini?
You can find me at Unmistakable Creative, pretty much anywhere where podcasts are available, you know, iTunes, Spotify, whatever. And then books are all on Amazon, and then just unmistakablecreative.com. Awesome. Like those are the places I would prefer people go to, all those places over any of my social media following. You know, it was like, we've helped, you know, Instagram and Facebook build their businesses big enough already.
That's fantastic. Srini, this was a lot of fun, really informative. So thank you so much for everything.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Enjoy your desi dinner.
Will do.
All right. Take care. Have a great weekend. Bye. That was the very talented Srini Rao. Very grateful for him to join us. We're definitely going to have a follow-up episode with him where he's going to come back to us and talk to us about his podcast. So I'm very excited about that. But I hope you guys had a good time. I'm trying to get some more very cool guests from Indian Matchmaking to come on and be a guest here, because I do want to hear that experience. I do want to, as a stand-up comic, I think one of the things that we kind of maybe get shy away from is going on a reality show, because a lot of comics, and I think I've had this discussion with fellow comics, is that we feel like it kind of dampens our talent in a way, or it kind of makes us a bit of a caricature. Now, I don't know if that's true, but that is definitely the kind of consensus that's out there among comics that I've spoken to. I want to shatter that. I want to hear that other side, hear that experience of what that's like. I mean, my personal take on Indian matchmaking is definitely there are moments of the cringeworthiness where like tall, fair, and slim. And it's just like, you know what? Fuck that. If you are a short, dark skinned girl with some meat on her bones, God bless you too. You know, you absolutely have the right to feel 100% about yourself because you are beautiful. And just like Srini and I just talked about, that the lack of conversation about character is a really telling. It's really telling of our culture stance, not just in India and Pakistan, just in South Asia, but also how our communities stand in the West. You know, the way we reside in the U.S. and Europe, and anywhere outside of South Asia. So I think that mentality definitely is being questioned and then being challenged. And I'm very, very proud of the fact that those conversations are happening. And I also get to be a part of that conversation. And I also get to contribute to that conversation. So I'm very, very excited about that. I do want to invite more people from the Indian matchmaking. I'm still going to say that Aparna is very interesting. I highly recommend that she does get therapy because she needs it. Mental health is such an overlooked thing. I don't know if you guys felt this way, but when I watched the characters, one thing I felt about them is that they were very very stiff, very rigid, very like a rigid way of communicating even, and very just very, very controlled, and there was no kind of sense of ease. I definitely felt that with Srini. I definitely felt that with Nadia. I definitely felt that a little bit with Shekhar also, who's in Chicago. Very sweet guy. Everybody else was definitely very, very, very rich. Relationships, or rather marriages, are looked at transactions. And that's how it came across to me on the show. It's a transaction. Oh, you have a tall, fair, and slim girl. We have a son who is tall, and his color skin doesn't matter. You know, his looks don't matter, but we have money. So we got money, you got looks, let's get together and maybe possibly have some semi-attractive children and, you know, live our lives so we can kind of all fit in that mold. And I definitely have never fit in that mold, nor do I wish to fit in that mold. I am very happy and I'm very proud and very content in the life choices I've made to become a stand-up comic and become an influencer in a way now and do the things that I do because I never pictured myself that way. Growing up, I never was the girl. I had girlfriends who were like, you know, who would tell me, oh, when I grow up, I'm going to marry a so-and-so guy. And they would ask me, they're like, what kind of guy would you marry when you grow up? I'm like, I'm not getting married. I was like, when I grow up, I want to travel the world. And even though I got married at 18, I got divorced at 27. I think what it did for me is that, that marriage is a whole different conversation. But I think once I kind of stepped out of my divorce and became my own woman, it brought back all the realization I had as a child of all the dreams that I had and all the dreams that I wanted to pursue and fulfill my destiny in many ways. And I'm very happy to say that, after eating shit for many years, I have finally kind of found my path to fulfilling my destiny, to fulfill the dream that I want to do. So I'm very happy. And I really want to take this time to thank you guys for coming along and being appreciative and watching this and supporting me. So it means the world to me. And honestly, for anybody listening to this, I know that no matter what culture, what religion, what background you come from, I feel anybody who dares to step outside of that, anybody who dares to walk their own individual path of spirituality and their own path of self-discovery and self-awareness, to me, would always be a hero. Hero or shiro, always. Because I think once you get to a place where you get to know yourself really well, nobody could ever take that away from you. Like, no one. There is just such power in it that power can never be taken away. Like, never. People can try to come in, try to come and try to fuck with you, try to mind fuck you in some ways, or try to try to challenge you in different ways. Because your core is so strong, because you chose to walk that path on your own, you made your bones on your own, you've been down in the darkness, and you've managed to crawl yourself out of it, and you managed to find this incredible deep strength within yourself, and you realize that no matter how many times you can be shot down or broken down or pushed down, you always have this incredible source of power within you that you just come together, you just glue it together, and you just rise up, man. And I think that has been the single-handed greatest lesson that I have learned throughout my journey, and I continue to learn that about myself. And I tell you guys the same thing. Please do that for yourself. Do that for yourself. Don't ever let the opinions of anyone define you and your life and how you're supposed to live and what values you're supposed to have. You're supposed to have your life the way you want to. You know, you are exactly where you're supposed to be. And I think I sometimes personally struggle with that, where I'm just like, man, I like to be a little further along and I like to do this. Yes, those are all great things and we would love to do that. But the truth is, I am exactly where I need to be. And I feel the same way about you. And I feel this pandemic has done great, but this pandemic has caused a lot of death and destruction, but it also has given the world pause. We are in pause. It is a time of reckoning. It is a time of realization. It is a time of self-reflection. And I think anybody who's not kind of taking the time to do that might not be taking advantage of where we are in the pandemic, because I think we all are kind of in the same boat, in the sense that we are all put on pause by this greater power than all of us. So take some time, reflect, have a lovely weekend. If you guys haven't subscribed to my YouTube channel, please do subscribe to my YouTube channel. I'm here Monday through Friday, bringing on incredible guests, bringing on amazing topics of the day, talking about some hard-hitting topics, throwing in a ton of comedy in there to make it fun and entertaining and inspiring, just like Srini said. But please, if you also haven't followed me on Instagram or Twitter at Mona's Comedy, I'm on Facebook at Mona Shea Comedian, please have a lovely, lovely weekend. Thank you so much for joining. Rahul said, you are amazing. Thank you, Rahul. You are amazing. Thank you for joining. Lalita Ji said, Akshay's mom. I will keep that in mind. I doubt if she will come on my show. And Rahul Mishra said, inshallah, you get what you want in life. Thank you, Rahul, very much. Thank you for those kind blessings. Thank you very much. Guys, have a great weekend. I will see you on Monday, 6:15 Pacific. Great weekend.